Well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about on the red car.
This was in a rather hard time for me, and the doctor to whom I had taken my mother called me and asked me to come in. This was an eye doctor, because she was losing her sight, mm-hmm. and he said that it was not only that, but he could tell from her eyes that she had cancer. Well, I had gone on the streetcar to go home with this pretty heavy on my heart, and a woman came and sat down beside me. I sat next to the window, and I had a paper, and I started to do the crossword puzzle. I just thought I had to do something to keep my mind going, but I just couldn't do it. I just was sitting there. And the woman started to talk to me, and she said, you know, I was a nurse in the war, and I've been a nurse ever since. My remembrance is that she was pretty nearly a middle-aged woman. But she said, you know, I've had a great deal of experience, but never in all my work with suffering people have I ever found anyone who had tried to live right, who was deserted in time of need. Now, you know, it always makes me weep now, but you know, how could it have happened? How could she have sensed, you know?
But you felt the same.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we weathered through this, and I think I finished talking about the experience in the First Congregational Church.
Yeah. We talked through Hawaii.
No, yes, we're in Hawaii.
Where we left off was the women, the Japanese girls learning English.
Yes. The YW really does always reach out to those in need and is not afraid to undertake new programs or go away from the set schedule.
The minorities.
Yes. You know, we had Japanese and Chinese and Koreans and Filipinos, but some blacks, mm-hmm. as well as the Hawis, we call them whites, in clubs and classes. And after the war, we gathered them in, and everybody was helpful. I remember the fine spirit there was, that we were in a very serious crisis, but everybody was ready to do whatever he or she could. And we reached out to help the servicemen and women and the wives of the servicemen that were in such a sad and unhappy state. Many had already lost their husbands, and others were seeing them go out for the big battles of Iwo Jima and Midway and so on, and to try to keep up heart and courage. We were so fortunate in leadership that we were able to draw in to work in groups with these women. I think I mentioned the Dr. Faust who came in and was marvelous. She was such a warm person and so practical and so concerned with these young women, but keeping it, you know, on a pretty cool level so that they wouldn't get emotional or upset. But it was really a trying time. And we had the servicemen coming in the building, and sometimes they would, well, sort of lose their mind temporarily. There was one young sailor jumped out of a second-story window. And there were sad things along. And then, of course, whenever there was an air raid warning, everybody would rush in and go down into our air raid shelter. And I would wend my way up to the third floor and get my fire extinguisher.
That must have been very lonely up there.
It really was. It was quite an empty place. Fortunately, I never had to use it, but you know, to have your gas mask and you had to have a card saying that you were allowed to drive, and there were many restrictions, and of course food was a difficulty too, although being at the YW we had at least usually were able to get one good meal a day there, because they, as soon as, you know, the first impact was over and things got straightened around, we could get government to help on, because there was served so many of the servicemen. But in those first days, when we took turns staying in the building overnight, that is just the white men, the howlers we call them, could be out. So we had to, the Orientals all had to go home. But I think I mentioned we had to get up early to get breakfast, and then we worked all day making sandwiches and preparing meals for them. And I know when we went home at sundown, about 6 o'clock, we were so tired we could hardly wiggle. Then we painted our windows black for the blackout, and then hung blankets over them to shut out. And I remember I saying we could either see or breathe, but we couldn't do both. It was very warm, you know, there, and to shut out everything. So you do it and read or do something and get your supper or whatever you needed, do your laundry or whatever, as long as you could stand it. And then turn out the lights and open the window. We used to lie under the bed with the radio to get the police calls, because then we knew what was going on and if there was any danger. But there was quite a lot of light from my radio. It had a long thing. It was given to me when I went over there. And so my housemate and I would put it under the bed. I had quite a large bed, and roll under.
I can see it. Listen
to what was going on in the world. We had first aid classes running all the time, and then we gradually, as the war got a little farther from us and it was a little safer, had other classes going. But I think those who came were very appreciative of it. We all, on the staff and the volunteers, worked really as hard as we knew how. We listened to the servicemen, and there were various activities for them at night. And we went to some of those, you know, USO sort of things, and supper with them, picture. And then as we gradually came out from that, my housemate, after I moved from Manoa Valley to live with a friend, Wilhelmina Rise, was quite an artist. And whenever there was a Saturday or Sunday afternoon that was free, she always wanted to go out to paint. And so I used to go along with her and started in, you know, doing sketches and doing a little painting. And it was wonderful because I could look at the beauty of the island beyond the barbed wire, because there was barbed wire everywhere. We would go down to the YW Beach Club, which was right on the shore, and it was right next to the fort. Anyway, it was right next to the fort. And if you were there, when the fort fired off its guns, the building would shake just like that. We wonder whether it was coming down. But it didn't. It was a lovely place to go. So you could go in swimming there and have a supper on the beach. And it was a very pleasant with our friends. So we began, as the war went on and got farther away from us, we could do a few more things. I think I mentioned before that while my parents opened up the love of books and reading to me, they also opened up the love of beauty. And I think I mentioned our view of the Neponset Valley in the spring with all the shades of green, and in the fall with all the gorgeous colors looking across to the blue hills of Melbourne. And then in Honolulu, and going out painting, we painted flowers, we painted the mountains. Eva painted very well, but I mixed the colors and made blotches that please me. Oh, you know, the flowering shower trees in the spring there, the poncianas, gorgeous colors. And the orchids and cups of gold. And I think I showed you that picture, didn't I, the cup of gold? that the little Japanese girl that was brought in to see if we could do anything to help her, because she tried to take her life. She was so alone and depressed by the war. And we introduced her to block printing and watercolor painting and oil, and she's going on. And this she sent me for Christmas, and isn't it lovely?
It's beautiful.
Cup of gold. She's really come to be quite an artist.
Wonderful.
She was such a lovely, sensitive young Nisei, Japanese girl. She wasn't, I think. She was, well, there were many like that. But
the kind of classes that you had for the Japanese, they were mostly to teach English to Chinese and Japanese?
The older Japanese.
Oh, not the first generation.
You see, that was a sad thing. The young ones had gone to school and learned English. The husbands had been out in the world and had learned English. But the little mothers were in the corner at home. They didn't even understand, excuse me, what their husbands and children were saying, because they were talking English then. It was very desirable, I felt, to talk
that
English in the war situation. So we gathered these Japanese women who had never been a block from their homes. And really, I'm still thrilled to remember, they came pouring in to the YW, their faces just shining, that they were beginning, you know, when they first learned a few words. There was one woman we discovered needed glasses, and we got some glasses for her. So she was always called eyeglasses. Here comes eyeglasses. And she just was beamed
about that.
And I don't know, it seemed to me that was one of the most moving, important programs we had. And we had a lovely young woman teaching it, who was a teacher at Punahou School, and had a real feeling for them and great ability as a teacher. So that was a very happy meeting.
Did a lot of them really master the language through that?
Enough to understand and speak, and yes. They're bright.
As soon as they learn the fundamentals, with it all around them, it shouldn't be too hard.
Yes. And it changed their lives completely, as their husbands' lives have been changed with the war, getting them off the plantations and their dependence on the plantation.
Were the Japanese in Hawaii, the women, very traditional? Were they traditional? Very.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And but they were very loyal to America, and they were the ones that destroyed a good many of their heirlooms and treasures because they felt so bad and so ashamed. So terribly ashamed of what Japan had done to us, and the many that were killed by those sudden attacks. Well,
according to that book that we both read, by anyway, a lot of them were killed by misfiring.
Yes.
Which is even more difficult to
swallow. Yes.
That's very unfortunate.
And they were afraid, of course, that if we were attacked, what would happen to them? If the Japanese came in, would they just attack, kill them just completely? And if our servicemen came in suddenly and saw them, would they think, they were the Japanese? Well, it was a very, very difficult time for them. And I think they came through beautifully, with great loyalty and willing to do anything they could. And I think I mentioned I had a little Japanese secretary who was a very bright young person, and it was very hard for her because she was intensely loyal. And of course, very unhappy with what had happened. Well,
as the war was winding down, what kind of new programs were you introducing then? Were you going back to the kinds of programs that you had before?
Well, I don't know. You see,
maybe you just came in.
I arrived in September, and we were plunged into the war almost immediately. I'd gotten some things going, and I think we developed further, the arts and crafts, Lahala weaving was very popular, and more painting classes, and more pottery. That was a very good, you know, that's a releasing kind of thing. And we had a very fine young person who was there in the Allens, who was quite skilled as a sculptress, and she taught that. We had a number of courses in that area, working with clay. Then, of course, we had new courses such as beginning Chinese and beginning Japanese for the servicemen. I had to buy the books for them, and I looked at them. I visited the classes, but I didn't have time. And of course, we had a large room given over to the Red Cross for making bandages and supplies. And we had a wonderful group of volunteers working every day there. And then the USO, Women's USO, moved into our building. And a friend of mine from Los Angeles was in charge of it. Her husband was with the YMCA USO. And it was so good to have her, because she was really an artist, and I enjoyed going out with her to paint. Sometimes the three of us would go. So,
did you keep up the painting at all? Were you ever doing?
No, I'm sorry that I didn't. I started when I came back to Pasadena, but there just didn't seem to be time. Mm-hmm. If, you know, you'll have to get out somewhere to find a place, quiet place, and materials ready, and I just had to give it up. It was too strenuous, my life. And so there was a real social revolution going on there in those years that I was there, and it was very interesting to observe. Of course, there were interracial marriages, and marriages can endure very happily there. I think probably they had the best opportunity there.
In Hawaii. Because there is so many different types
of
people.
Mm-hmm. There weren't many blacks my time. We did have one black staff member for a while, a very interesting young woman. And I think her husband got transferred to Washington and she had to leave us. And there were blacks, but not very many, but some. And I think since the war, perhaps there have been more. I know that there have been happy intermarriages there that probably wouldn't have survived on the mainland. Well, then...
Is Hawaii one of your favorite places now?
Yes. It was a fascinating place. There was a time of terror there, because we didn't know what was going to happen to us, and we were a little island way out away from everybody. But fortunately, we were so busy with what there was to do that we didn't have time to be scared and dwell on it.
You were coming into a new organization at a very trying time.
Yes.
That must have, didn't you ever feel, what am I doing here?
No, I don't think I did. It's such a, when I went, I found such a beautiful place. And I found that the YWCA was full of interest with all these various Oriental groups. I never had a chance to work with Orientals. I didn't know them, maybe one or two here and there, but it was marvelous to see them, and so happy. And as I had to learn some of the different ways of work with them. The Japanese were too polite to tell you that there was something already scheduled on a certain day, so that they let you go ahead with something, knowing that they couldn't come, but not telling you, because that wouldn't be polite. But they were wonderful to work with, and I enjoyed them very much. And it was an experience that I treasure, really. And when I was setting up the other classes, the Pacific Roundtable, for instance, when we were really making a study of the Pacific Islands and what was going on in our past history. It was a very interesting course because we had marvelous talent to draw on to give the lectures. It is a crossroads there. And the people who had lived there, the Hawaiis and the Malahinis, I think they called, lived there for years, had traveled all over the Pacific. And we had really very stimulating talent to draw on. Of course, it was the University of Hawaii, too. Then friends of mine, Andrew Lynn, Catherine Lynn, she was on the staff there on the board. Anyway, she was active in the YW, and he was professor at the university, and his specialty was race relations. He was called on several times to speak over the radio about the situation in Honolulu as far as race relations were going. I learned so much there. I don't know that it ever showed anywhere, but I felt, you know, that I was expanding my horizon.
How long were you in Hawaii?
5 years. I stayed until after the end of the war and then came to Pasadena.
Must have been a very jubilant time, the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. I saw the excitement of the end of the war there. And Roosevelt died that spring, I think, indeed. And I was in a meeting in the YMCA building up on the second floor. And when he came downstairs, someone was saying, "Roosevelt has died." And it was a terrible shock. And I went out on the street then, and I saw Japanese and Orientals with tears just running down their faces. They just, you know, felt that there was a friend there that they had. And I thought that was really a marvelous tribute. Then I came back to Pasadena. And
why was that? Why did you come back?
Well, we were told that you shouldn't stay in the islands less than 2 years or more than 5 years.
Why?
Well,
because it was such a desirable place?
No, because it's very warm, and many got into a kind of a lethargic way, I had friends in California, and I thought maybe it was the time to come back. And I was offered the executive director job in Pasadena, and this was the area in which I had friends, in which my friend Marion Bell, who was a USO, had already
returned.
So, but I came back to find that Pasadena was recovering from the war, too. The building hadn't had anything done to it because they couldn't do repairs. And so there was a problem in getting that and getting staff for it and getting a program going because the program had pretty nearly died.
What are the executive director's duties as opposed to what you were doing before as a program?
Well, it means you have responsibility for
the whole
organization. You have
and
to work
the Pasadena organization.
Yeah. The board and all the committees and the staff. And
it's quite a responsibility.
Yes, it is. We had one time 35 on the staff, and we built up, I think, an excellent, excellent program, and we had some wonderful staff members. There again, we tried to reach out to those with needs that weren't being met. We did several things. There was an influx of blacks into Pasadena this time, and there was quite a feeling of concern about that on the old Pasadenans that were disturbed to see what was happening. So we thought maybe we should try to do something with the teenagers who were the ones that were getting into trouble dropping out of school and drinking, and I don't know whether they were taking drugs at that time or not. I don't seem to remember, but I know they were probably were drinking illegitimate babies. And we thought if we could gather them in, maybe we could, you know, get them back to school, get them on a better way of life. And we got the most marvelous psychiatric social worker. She couldn't work full time. She was black. And she drew these girls in. And I remember the first time she had the group together there, she came in to tell me about it. And she said that they said, she said that she asked them if they'd like to have a name for that club. And she said they thought about it for a while. And they said, well, they like to be the soul talking buddies. Because they wanted to talk about the deep down things. They didn't want to talk about the just the, those things, superficial things. Well, Melva was marvelous with those girls. She did a lot for them. Some of them she got back into school, and one was determined to go to college and be a social worker like Melva. She, there were gangs formed in Pasadena, and there were very bad gang fights. So Melva got involved in that too. We were fortunate. There was a young policeman that was interested in the gang fights and in the trouble. And I invited him over to meet Melva, and took them in the cafeteria and got some cups of coffee or whatever, and then I left them. And I looked in after a while, and they were just going, you know, like that. So I thought, oh, it's going to work. And they did. And Melva went to some of the meetings with these gangs, and one night she'd been at a meeting with the girls, and they said, you must come to this meeting with the boys because they're going to have a big fight with a gang from Los Angeles, and something terrible will happen. And Melva said to me after, she was really scared to go, but she went, and she talked to them about not seeing if they couldn't work out something with them and not have a fight. And she suggested that wouldn't they like to have just a little get-together and have some refreshments and talk over their problems. Well, they thought that would be a good idea, and they would do that. And she said, well, now, where would you like to meet? Oh, YWCA. And so we talked with the young policeman, and he talked with the probation man, whoever, was this gang in Los Angeles that was really a fierce gang. Anyway, they all came over, and I alerted the desk that night that there were all these blacks coming in, not to be alarmed. There was going to be somebody with them, and Melva was going to be with them, and it was all right. Well, of course, we always had sitters coming in to sit in the lobby, and so those sitters had to be calmed down, because you know, these were big fellas, big blacks, you know, and to see a whole troop of them coming in or something. Well, we had in our lounge, Melva was in charge, and she got punch and cookies for them. And so the first thing, before they started, they had punch and cookies. I just looked from the outside. I didn't go in because I thought Melva and this young policeman were doing all right. And but she said afterwards, you know, they were just as gentlemanly as they could be. They sat and drank their punch and ate the cookies. And we talked about this, and they decided that it wouldn't be necessary to have a fight. And, you know, there were things that we were a little nervous about occasionally, but that worked out all right. Then we tried, there were children in a couple of the schools in the fourth and fifth grades that were troublemakers. They just would disrupt the whole class. And Melva talked with the principal about them. I guess I talked to them first. And they thought if something could be done with those children, it would save a whole class of children. So we invited them to the YWCA, Melva in charge. And when they came in, they were really just little ragamuffins. They just went like that all over the building. And it was quite a building to go over. It was out in the pool and up in the residence and up in the club rooms, all over. Well, anyway, Melva finally got them corralled, and she took them out to the park, and she said, now you're not going into the building again until you learn how to behave. So they met for several weeks in the park. Then they came in and had some meetings in the YW, and they did what they wanted to do. Some of them made little shifts, you know, saying how to do that, and some of them learned to cook some little things for them to have for refreshments. And I don't know what all. It was mostly talking with them and doing whatever Melba thought was advisable at the time. And then at Christmas, they had a little Christmas party for their mothers. And I went with, you know, those children came in. You couldn't have seen better behaved youngsters than those were. They had on these new little cotton shifts that they made, and they had the hair all, you know, what they did about fourth or fifth grade. Little ribbons on it, and very sober and very dignified. We went up to the club room and had punch and cake. There was a frosting on the cake, I think it was red and purple, which is kind of exciting, but any ill effects. But you know, Melba cared about them, and the schools were very appreciative. As I said, it had made a great deal of difference. Then, with a little older girls, as well as his black soul-talking buddies that Melba had, we started a big sister program. And the schools and the probation and the police referred girls to us that were headed for trouble. Mm-hmm. And we had volunteer women for big sisters. And that was very successful. We were very careful in setting it up, and the plan of screening the big sisters to see that, you know, there wasn't any self-motivation.
Yeah, right.
But I remember a couple things that happened. One big sister invited the little sister to her home for dinner with her husband. Well, the little sister's table manners were atrocious. But the husband, this young husband, took it on. He said, now if you're going to come to our house to dinner, and I hope you will, you've got to have good table manners, because I can't eat at the table with anybody with manners that you have. And so they taught the child good table manners. And you know, that whole thing changed that child's attitude. She knew how to be a nice person, and she knew what fault to use and, you know, how to behave.
So just having an interest outside the home made a big difference for all of these people.
And it helped in families, too. There was one family that the big sister went to see, the parents. We usually try to get a good relation with the parents so they know what was going on. But the family never sat down to a meal together. The children just came in and got something to eat, and the father the same, and a couple of children. Well, the big sister worked with the family then and got the father interested in the children and what was going on, and seeing that his wife was kind of had let go, you know, and was, no, anyway. So the father responded, and he got his wife to clean herself up and look better and get meals for them. You know, and the child was so pleased with this change in her family life. Well, those were just a couple of things that happened. But it was really, I think, a very rewarding program. And we had quite large teenage Y-teen clubs, as they were called, in the schools. They were very active in a number of things. And then the first summer I was there, the YW had purchased a camp just before I went on the staff. So we had a camp program at Camp Pocklets Meadows. And I was at a meeting the other day of the Pomona Valley YWCA, and they had a group go up to Pocklets Meadows. And I was so pleased, you know, that it's reaching out again. And they reported on it, what a wonderful time they'd had as teenagers. But it was a terrible struggle on that camp to staff it and to finance it and keep it going. And the other YWCAs used it quite extensively in the summer, so we thought maybe we could have a YWCA council of the all the YMCAs in the area, five or six YMCAs, you know, to help in financing it and supporting it and planning the program and have a camp director. Well, we did that, and it seemed to work pretty well for a while, but the others, there was financial expense in it, and they just felt that they couldn't support it, so they handed it back to Pasadena. So, anyway, I'm glad that Pasadena still has it, and is developing it for all year-round camping.
Pasadena is one of the larger Ys, isn't mm-hmm. it? Pasadena is one of the larger
yes,
Ys, isn't
yes.
it?
It's been yes, a very sound YMCA. And,
what other kind of programs did you have there in your...
See, I worked with the board and the executive committee and the finance committee and the personnel committee and the program planning committee and the public affairs committee. We had a very live public affairs committee, and I enjoyed working with that. It got us into trouble sometimes, but...
Because of the reform interest?
You know, we worked quite a little with the League of Women Voters and I had joint meetings. And we were in favor of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And there were those in Pasadena who were definitely not in favor of it. Then really the worst time we had was when the YW supported Medicare, or health insurance. The national bid and convention voted it, and we supported it in Pasadena. And the doctors were very irate about it. And we had the wife of a doctor on our board, and she resigned, making a very strong statement about what we were doing. And this Medicare was entirely wrong. We shouldn't support it. And the doctors, the American Medical Association group in Pasadena, went to the community chest and tried to have us put out of the community chest. And they also sent someone to New York to tell them what Pasadena was doing and that we should be disaffiliated. Then we had a meeting.
It had been voted in the convention, though.
Yes.
In which convention was that?
That's our national convention.
Oh, so it was a national policy.
Every 3 years.
Right.
Yes. It wasn't anything we'd gone out by ourselves.
Did you used to attend those conventions?
Mm-hmm.
You attended the conventions?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Every 3 years was
right.
A convention. And
so it was national policy, so going
yes.
to New York didn't help
no.
them at all.
But we had the doctor said they would not give any money to the community chest while we were in the chest, which of course frightened the community chest considerably. We invited the doctors aboard of this medical association to come and discuss the matter with our board, our executive board. And I will never forget that meeting. They wouldn't yield a hair. And neither would our women, I'm glad to say, yield a hair. And we felt that this was right, and we were going to do it.
Well, did they feel they were going to lose money on the deal? Is
yes.
Mm-hmm. Because the government wouldn't come up with the...
You know, we found out heard afterwards that they were members of the John Birch Society.
I believe that.
You know.
Yeah. The ones that were against the United Nations were no doubt.
Yes.
So.
But it was an awfully hard time.
When was this?
I started getting gray. Yeah, I got telephone calls and someone said I was going to be booted out of town. You know, it was really rough.
When was this, do you know?
Well, when did Medicare start?
I don't know. It's going strong now.
Yeah. Yes.
So was Medi-Cal.
Must have been in the 50s.
Probably.
Well, maybe 60. Could it have been that late?
I don't think so. I
haven't
looked on the YWCA at home. I'll look it up.
Good. it was really... And New York wanted me to report, so every time we had a meeting or got anything from either the chest or the doctors, I wrote a report on it and sent it to New York. And then we, all this time, you know, we were struggling with the regular program, and well, my hair certainly turned gray during that period. We had a cafeteria. We had a very good cafeteria, but that was losing money. So that was a problem. But we managed to get out of that. And we got a couple in there to manage it. We're very good, so we made money for a while.
And big deal of responsibility, didn't you?
It was. And the responsibility for staff, that, you know, working in some controversial areas. And it were very hard things. There was one woman who was quite an influential person, came in to see me one day, that the chest had not made its gold, and she said that we are going to close your gymnasium and pool. You can't afford to have that. And, well, I was kind of stunned by it, but I said, oh, no, you can't do that. And she said, well, it's limited money, and that's too expensive. And I said, but that is self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
That it's bringing in money, and it's serving the community. We have all age groups in there. We had swimming classes for the blind and handicapped, and those were sent to us by doctors, as well as recreational swimming and diving and a big dance and exercise program in the gymnasium. And but she fought with me about an hour, and I said, no, we are not. We just simply could not close that part of our program. And she finally left me, and I never heard anything more about it. So, but there were things like that, you know, were a little rough.
Required a lot of strength on your part.
Well, I was fortunate that I had good members on the board who weren't frightened by controversy.
Well, they wouldn't
have been stopped. And the husbands weren't frightened either. So, but that was hard, because some husbands were in positions where pressure could be brought against them. And some of the doctors didn't agree with the other doctors, but they weren't in a position to stand against them because, well, some of them were in the profession that with referrals where they did special things.
Right.
You know, it was a very sad situation. It was something that I learned about the hardness of men in that meeting. There wasn't a bit of sympathy when we told about this Medicare, that we were concerned about the whole family and what this would mean.
The burden to the children.
They just were adamant.
It's been difficult for you to